Well, I know that we waited 7.5 years to have a baby after trying all that time. I think she was just a week old when we took her back in to the doctor. And he walked into the office, and here I am so proud of this little bitty baby. And he says, "Well, I have some bad news for you. I've been thinking all night how to tell you this." And as soon as he said that, I get this ringing in my head. I couldn't even hear what he said for the 10 seconds. I was so shocked. What's the matter with my baby? And he knew very little about PKU. So he really didn't have any idea how to explain it to me without getting me upset. All he knew was that it can cause mental retardation. And when I heard that word, retardation, believe it or not, it was almost a relief to me, because I remember thinking to myself, I don't care if she's retarded as long as she's not going to die. That's how scared I was when he said that. Those are remarks by a patient reported in the book Bad News, Good News. What happens when we talk to doctors, and how important is it to our health? I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
Conversation analysts study how people communicate or don't communicate with each other. What can be learned from studying the way doctors ask questions, use medical terminology, deliver good and bad news, and make small talk with their patients? Joining us to explore doctor-patient communication is Douglas Maynard, professor and chair of sociology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and co-editor of Communication in Medical Care, Interaction Between Primary Care Physicians and Patients. He's also the author of Bad News, Good News, Conversational Order in Everyday Talk and Clinical Settings.
Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
It sounds like a tough thing to do in a way, to study something like small talk, which by its very nature would be altered, I would think, by the studying. But how does this whole process come about, and who came up with the idea?
Conversation analysis is a field that's about 40 years old now, started in the 1960s. It started in the field of sociology, but it has made its way into linguistics, or at least the subfield known as applied linguistics, and also communications. Some of the early data for conversation analysis were tape recordings that at that particular time could be done over party lines, for example, where it could be done surreptitiously and without getting permissions. That's no longer possible to do. But in those cases, well, it's interesting. Actually, there are laws about this that vary from state to state. And for example, Wisconsin has what's known as the one-party consent rule, which means that you can record your own telephone calls, in a sense, give yourself consent without informing your co-participant on the other end of the line that you're recording your conversation. Other states, Indiana is one of those, have a two-party consent rule, and you're not even allowed to record your own telephone conversations. But at any rate, some telephone call conversations were recorded and done so without the party's knowledge. And of course, then there's not the issue of contaminating the data. More recently, we always get participants' permissions, and this is particularly true in medical settings where we have to get internal review board permissions to do the videotaping in many cases, as well as audio taping. And we always get human subjects approval. We have forms for patients, for doctors, in other kinds of settings, for whoever is being taped. And over the years, it's been shown in various ways, I don't think we need to go into the detail, but that the recording, even the presence of the researcher in the setting, doesn't substantially influence how people talk. Just to give you one example, when people are getting diagnostic news, that event is so intense for both the doctor and the patient that while at the beginning they may pay attention and make jokes even about a video camera in the room, in a few seconds they completely forget about the presence of a recorder and they get involved in the conversation, and pretty much you can say they're not going to be influenced by the presence of any kind of recording technology or even the researcher.
But wouldn't it be like, for example, that example that I read from your book at the beginning where a woman is getting news about her child with PKU, the idea of recording something, in that case, it's just her remarks about it, just telling about it. But if a video camera had been there when she was learning the news, that seems so intrusive. Do you get permission ahead of time then, as patients are going to get the diagnosis?
Yes, we do get permission ahead of time. And I have videotapes of clinics where parents are being told of the developmental disability of a child. And myself doing this research, I called the parents beforehand and talked to them on the phone. And then when they arrived at the clinic, I talked to them again, and then they signed a form. In that case, we had a video camera behind a two-way mirror, and they couldn't see me or the camera or the research assistant who was working with me. But they were well aware that they were being video recorded. And again, once the informing interview, as it's called, gets underway, they're so intensely involved in what the clinicians have to say about their child who's undergone a great deal of testing that you can pretty much tell by their own reports say that they are forgetting about the recording, and they get involved in the conversation.
And how do you get them to buy into this idea that you want to record this conversation?
Well, the main thing is that we have wanted to understand better how diagnostic news is presented to patients or family members, and that by studying it in the way that we as conversation analysts study it, we can make suggestions about how it can be improved, and that their participation in this process is really going to not only just help our research, and to some extent we are just basic researchers, but also in the long run it's going to benefit other families, it's going to benefit the medical profession, it's going to benefit medical education and those kinds of things. And people pretty much do want to help out in that regard, in my experience.
Well, my husband's a physician, and I know one of the things that he feels in the healthcare system right now is that often doctors don't have enough time. They're not paid adequately, or the way the whole system works doesn't allow them to spend much time talking and listening to patients the way they crucially need to do. If you look at a very brief encounter between doctor and patient, what are some of the things that you found about what happens in that initial contact between doctor and patient?
Well, the average amount of time, you know, for a primary care visit is about 11 minutes, research has shown. And there's a very common perception that if doctors, for example, were more careful in various ways about conducting the communication, that that would elongate the interview and they wouldn't be able to see as many patients or get through the order of the day. There's research, and particularly from a conversation analytic point of view, that has shown this notion to be more of a stereotype than a point of fact. One of those pieces of research was done quite a while ago by Richard Frankel and Howard Beckman, who showed that doctors tend to, at the beginning of the interview, interrupt patients relatively soon when they are describing what their complaint is. And doing so, they then prevent patients from giving more than just one concern. And when doctors are taught to not interrupt so quickly and to listen for more than one concern, it's been shown that, in fact, it doesn't actually elongate the interview. There's another very recent bit of research that I think is just forthcoming in the Journal of General Internal Medicine. This is by John Heritage and Jeff Robinson, showing that they did an experimental manipulation in which some doctors were told to ask their patients whether they had any more medical concerns. This was after they had explored the basic one, or whether they had some more medical concerns. And a little manipulation in that one word of any versus some showed that when doctors asked patients if they had any more concerns, that tended to convey an expectation that they didn't have
right.
any more. And patients usually said no, whereas when they asked the question, do you have some more concerns, that conveyed a more openness, and patients often reported, and the data show that they tend to report more medical complaints. Once again, however, this did not elongate the medical interview. And so that's a really interesting finding.
One of the interesting points you make in, I can't remember which one of your books it was, but it was about how patients felt like apologizing almost for being there, that we have a sort of stiff upper lip approach so that if you go to the doctor, you almost feel like saying, I didn't want to bother you with this, or I waited 3 months, or something that almost makes you, I suppose, maybe fear of being seen as a hypochondriac or coming in too easily.
Yes. Well, the term that John Heritage evoked to describe this situation is doctorability. That is that when we go to the doctor, we want to be sure that we have a complaint that is doctorable. And another researcher in our edited book by the name of Tim Halkowski showed that what we do is show ourselves to be reasonable patients, meaning that we want to show that we pay enough attention to our body so that if something comes up, we're aware of it, and then we go seek help from the doctor. But we also don't want to be showing ourselves to be overly concerned and hypochondriacal, you know, for example, so that we come into the doctor with just any little thing that happens to us, a little sniffle, a little cough, a little bit of pain here or there. And so you can see patients saying things like, well, I was just shaving this morning and I noticed that I had this little lump on my face, and, you know, I don't even really know whether it's something you want to look at, but I thought I should come in. So by saying, you know, that I was shaving this morning, you're showing that it came up in the course of shaving. It's not like you're standing in front of the mirror looking for things to go to the doctor with.
Or you mentioned the third-party thing. Somebody else told me I should come and
see
you.
That's right.
I gather there was a considerable thinking that things were being missed in these patient-doctor conversations, and that's what prompted this whole phenomenon in the past 40 years of studying.
Not only in the doctor-patient interview, conversation analysis started out and continues to be concerned with what we call ordinary conversation. And yes, there was a perception that much of what happens between people in their daily lives was being missed by investigators in social science fields who wanted to know what was going on in people's everyday lives. And partly through the development of recording technology, it became easier to get very detailed records of how people were talking and interacting with one another. And the idea was that it was important, and it is important, to pay attention to the small nuances and details of everyday talk in just our ordinary conversations, but also, of course, crucially in medical settings, because it's in these details, it's in these nuances, it's in these little things, perturbations, hesitations, silences, the tone of a person's talk, that certain kinds of things are being communicated. We put it as these are where and how we engage in certain kinds of social actions. One example would be when somebody makes an assertion and the other party is going to agree with that assertion, they're going to agree with it right away without pausing, without a silence. If the other party is going to disagree with the first party's assertion, they're going to, over and over and over again, you see people pausing, emitting a rather large silence. And it's a signal that there's going to be a disagreement. And it's so much a signal that what we do, if we're the first party who's made the assertion, we will often modify the assertion that we've made in order to get the person to agree with us. So those little things, silences, overlapping talk, those kinds of things turn out to be crucially important in understanding how talk is organized, how it is that we communicate with one another, how it is that we're engaged in certain kinds of activities with one another.
Can you study body language at all?
We also study body language. We started out studying telephone talk because it eliminated the need to study body language, because that's a very complex aspect of communication. But in more recent years, and again, partly because of our technological developments, we are engaging in studies of nonverbal aspects of talk as well.
I know you have some transcripts with you of conversations between doctors and patients. I'm wondering, could you give us a little sample and then tell us what you as a conversation analyst can deduce about the doctor, about the patient, how you might take something recorded and help other people learn from it?
Sure. A recent study that I've been doing with Pam Hudak, who's at the University of Toronto, has to do with what Norman mentioned at the beginning, which is small talk. Small talk is a really interesting thing in doctor-patient communication as well as elsewhere, and it refers to talk about the weather, just general how are you inquiries. Could be talk about the basketball game last night. Could be talk about who the person is other than being a patient, what their occupation is or what their avocation is and that kind of thing. And it has some really interesting properties in doctor-patient interaction, and it has been described certainly as being a way in which doctor and patient can be sociable with one another and not just engaged in the instrumental tasks associated with the medical goals of the encounter. But what we're finding is that small talk does other kinds of things. And I'll just read from a transcript. This is in an orthopedic surgery clinic. It's data that a doctor and researcher by the name of Wendy Levinson collected. And the patient has come to the doctor because he has been suffering from back pain. And in fact, about 7 years before this encounter, he had already had some surgery. And one of the questions is whether his back pain has gotten bad enough again that he should have more surgery. And he's already been recently treated with certain kinds of injections, steroid injections, and also with a painkiller called Celebrex. And the doctor starts by saying to the patient, how did that Celebrex work? Did that help? And the patient says, yeah, I think it does. And he says, I'm not great, but I think it's stabilized and it might be even improving a little bit. The doctor says, good, boy, that's all it takes is just a little improvement. Now, one thing to notice here is that when the patient answers the doctor's question about how the Celebrex worked, he says three things. He first says, I'm not great. And then he goes on with, but it's stabilized and it might be even improving a little bit. So there's some clear equivocation in there. He ends by saying it might even be improving a little bit. And this is where our attention to detail is important, because when he says it might even be improving a little bit, the doctor comes in overlapping that last bit of talk to say, good. Boy, that's all it takes.
And now you're out of my office.
Yeah. And so he's, in a sense, ignored the equivocation, like it might be, and I'm not great, and maybe it's stabilized, and all of those hesitating remarks that preceded the possibility that might be improving.
And what was the doctor's question again?
The doctor's question was, how did that Celebrex work? Did that help?
So he's actually inviting the patient to say yes.
That's true. Very good point. He's also suggesting that, by the way he's constructing his question, that the medication helped.
Now, that doesn't have any small talk in it, though.
Well, I'm coming to
the
small
talk. Oh, you're coming
to
it. Okay.
So right after the doctor says, after the patient has said it might even be improving a little bit, the doctor says, good, boy, that's all it takes is just a little improvement. And then he says, how's your woodworking career? And the patient says, my woodworking career? The patient is caught off guard. He happens to be someone who has an outside interest away from his usual occupation, and the doctor knows this because they know one another. That's the small talk. And the patient says, my woodworking career? He's caught off guard. He's taken aback because this question is produced so suddenly and so quickly after they've been doing the medical talk. But that exhibits the pattern that we're interested in, which is that we find doctors, when patients are producing medical complaints that might not be right on target with what it is that the doctor is prepared to deal with, it's at those points in the conversation where the doctor will initiate some kind of small talk. So it's a way of disattending, we call it, the patient's medical complaint. And so it's just an interesting feature of small talk, and an example of paying attention to that kind of detail is important. You know, on the other hand, what we're also finding is that patients initiate small talk when doctors are making treatment recommendations that the patients don't particularly want to adhere to. And I can give you an example from this same interview. This is later in the interview. Now, remember, this doctor and patient know one another. And after the doctors had a chance to explore the patient, to do the physical exam, to see how the back is doing and that kind of thing, they get back on well, exactly what are your symptoms like? And the patient, again, is equivocating. He says, remember, I was here about a month and a half ago. I said it was so bad I could hardly walk across the parking lot, but it lasted like a couple, twice in the last year, but it happens a couple of days. Then it goes back to this sort of metal roar kind of thing. And he says, and now since this Celebrex seemed to have stabilized in the little roar where I'm not feeling great, but it hasn't gotten worse. Then the doctor says, are you doing the flexion exercises? And the patient says, well, it's been so cold. I've been wanting to do some walking, but it's... And the doctor says, well, you ought to do those flexion exercises. You can do those, you know, in the house, in your living room, right in front of the fire. And the patient says, yeah. And the doctor says, that ought to do well. And the patient says, well, you know, it seems to me at least it's stabilizing. It's not getting worse. And the doctor says, good, well, that's a good sign. I'll take that all day long. And they do a little bit of joking. And then the patient says, how's your daughter? And the doctor says, you're talking about the orthopedist? And the patient says, no, I mean the little girl. And it turns out that the doctor has several daughters. And they end up talking about the doctor's family. And so here the patient, having been urged to do his flexion exercises, uses a small talk initiation to get off of that topic.
So the doctor should be saying, well, my daughters are all fine. They've been doing their exercises.
Yeah, exactly. That would be a good way to go.
More on doctor-patient talk when we continue in a moment with University of the Air. The doctor did not say anything at all when the baby was born. Then he said, it's a boy. And the way he hesitated, I immediately said, is he all right? And he said he has 10 fingers and 10 toes, so in the back of my mind, I knew there was something wrong. Patient remark reported in the book Bad News, Good News. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Doug Maynard, and we're talking about doctor-patient communication. Let's talk about the idea of bad news, which all of us have had that fear, especially as parents, going to a doctor's office and waiting for the bad news.
Absolutely. When we're waiting for news, it's one of the most difficult times, just as a parent or as a patient or a family member, not knowing whether you're going to get bad news or whether it could possibly be good news. It's that state of not knowing that is so uncomfortable. And sometimes, in fact, even when the news turns out to be bad, patients or family members report being relieved because finally they have some definition, because something has been going on. They know something has been going on, and nobody has been able to define it. So, yeah, that waiting period is particularly difficult. The example that you read where the doctor doesn't say anything, this was an example where a child was born who had Down syndrome. And sometimes doctors will, instead of being forthright with the diagnosis and what it is that they know, they'll avoid saying it. And the fact that that happens gives some sense of how difficult it is for the physician to have to present this kind of news. So it's important to understand the difficulties both for the presenter as well as the family member or recipient of the news. But it's been shown that that kind of stalling is a way that it just prolongs that disorientation that, in this case, the mother was already in a sense, and having to await some kind of news and having herself a sense that something was not quite right with her newborn.
Well, if you look at conversation that reports bad news to parents, let's just say like the PKU case that we opened the hour with, after you've studied many, many different conversations that occur between doctors and patients where bad news is delivered, what sort of recommendations then do you end up making that could be incorporated into medical education?
When I was studying the developmental disabilities clinic, it turned out that there were two distinct patterns that turned up in these informing interviews. Some doctors, when they had the diagnosis, and let's just use the example of mental retardation, would, in the informing interview, start out by saying something like, you know, I realize that this has been a very difficult time for you as parents, but we've completed our studies now, and what we've found is that your child is slow And I have one interview, in fact, in which the clinician says, your child is slow, he is retarded. And the mother breaks down into tears and says, no, he's not retarded, he's not retarded. And it's a very direct way of delivering the news, and some physicians feel it's important to be that direct with the news. That directness was one pattern. The other pattern was that the pediatrician would start out by asking the parent, you've been with your child now for whether it's months or years, what do you think is going on with your child? And then the parent would say, well, you know, I really noticed that the child is pretty slow. And then the physician can come back with the diagnosis and say, yes, we've found the same thing. Your child is slow. The tests are showing this. The tests are showing that it's probably going to be a long-term problem. And in this kind of case, we call that mental retardation. It's a very different way of presenting the news by asking your family member. And it happens that some physicians also use this device of asking their patient who's getting the news, what do you think has been going on? And I have one instance, for example, where the patient herself says, I think I've got cancer. And the physician then can say, you know, you're right. That's what we have found. You have a cancer. The importance of that is that by asking the patient or the family member, the physician is asking about their experience and getting their knowledge and their beliefs, and then tying the clinical findings to what the patient or family member already knows or believes. And it's a very affirming way of proceeding, and it's a way also of using the patient's perspective or the family member's perspective to affirm the diagnostic news. And so it's a very collaborative way of entering that news delivery process. And it seems much more effective than just outright and directly telling a diagnosis where, in a sense, the clinician is very presumptive, presuming that the patient doesn't have a clue and that they, as the clinician, have all the knowledge and all of the expertise. And here's what it is that we ourselves know, and then the family member is just the passive recipient.
If you say your child is retarded, mm-hmm. that raises a red flag for a lot of people, whereas if it's more complicated than that, you can work your way into it more gently, perhaps?
Yes. And, you know, I have instances where, in a sense, the parents flat out reject a term like mental retardation, but by asking them, you know, well, what have you seen at home? What's going on with your child? Then they can use the parents' observations to say, well, you noticed this. You noticed that Johnny is much slower than his sister Emily was at this same age, that he's not doing the same things that she was doing. And what our tests are showing is that he is behind his age category and what he should be able to do. Our tests are also showing that this is apparently not a short-term condition. And in that case, that's what the term mental retardation is used to refer to. And so they can put it in a sense, in a gentler fashion and also tie it to the observations of the parents rather than making it just a diagnostic term that's out there in the abstract.
One of the things that my husband has mentioned is a specialist where he sees people who have been seen by a primary care physician or someone else who then come to him. If he asks them, what have doctors told you so far, what he finds is that most of the patients that he deals with have no clue how to interpret the medical language they've been given about their own conditions.
Yes.
That they're struggling with all the fancy terms and all the rest of it to make sense of it. And that part of the, I mean, we haven't talked about it yet, but the doctor-patient talk, a lot of times the medical jargon gets in the way.
I'd have to agree. And it seems like your husband is doing a version of the perspective, what I call the perspective display sequence, that is asking the patient what they know already. And that's such a good way of proceeding because then he can deal with the fact that they may have been presented with a lot of jargon that they don't understand. And that is a big problem. Oftentimes the physician will present to a patient their diagnosis. And one of the ways that jargon comes up is that particularly when it's a difficult diagnosis, a serious diagnosis, something more than just high blood pressure, let's say, a cancer, the patient is going to be silent once they hear that word. And physicians, well, all of us, I guess, are very uncomfortable with silence. And a way of dealing with that silence on the part of physicians I've found in my research is that they then immediately start talking and laying on the patient these sometimes jargonistic terms to explain what it is that they have and what it is that the treatment is going to be. And the patient is still reeling from having heard the diagnosis in the first place. And even if the terminology that then comes forth is something that they could ordinarily understand, because they're reeling from the initial diagnostic informing, they're not going to hear it, they're not going to understand it, they're going to be very confused. So another thing that I try to coach physicians about is learning how to be comfortable with silence after you've presented a diagnosis. And rather than proceeding, when you as the doctor are ready to proceed, asking the patient for guidance. You know, I can tell that this is hard for you to accept right now, or you're being very quiet. And if you would like, we can stay quiet for a while, but maybe you can let me know what you would like to do next. Would you like me to explain more of this? Would you rather just stay quiet for a while? Would you like to step out of the room and come back? What would you like to do?
There's always that, I hate to be dismissive about it, but the handy-dandy literature.
Yes.
It can fill the silence. Here's a couple of pamphlets about your condition.
That's right, and that's another thing that happens regularly in these contexts.
Well, with bad news, good news, another kind of standard approach that we use not only in a sort of a medical setting but just in general is so which do you want first, the bad news or the good news?
Right. Well, one of the interesting things about bad news and good news is what I call the asymmetry between bad news and good news. The asymmetry has to do with how bad news is something, of course, that we dislike, whereas good news is something that we tend to like. And those likes and dislikes tend to turn up in our conversational practices, so that one of the things you see happening with bad news is that it gets hidden away. It gets packaged in such a way as to keep it brief and keep it out of sight, out of mind, so to speak. I call it shrouding. Bad news is shrouded, whereas in our talk practices, we tend to expose good news. And a way of exposing the good news is by asking a patient, for example, I've got bad news and I've got some good news. Which would you like first? Almost invariably, patients are going to say, let's get the bad news out of the way. And that means that you only talk briefly about the bad news, and then you can talk more extendedly about the good news because it comes second, and that means that it's implicative for further talk. But it happens in other kinds of ways also. We tend to lead up to bad news when we have it by often signaling it or doing what I call forecasting. I've got some bad news. Yeah, what is it? Well, it's something you're not going to like. Okay, well, tell me. Well, are you sitting down? Yeah, I'm sitting down if this is on the phone. Okay, and then they will tell the news. Whereas on the phone, when you have good news, often you're going to just blurt it out right away. So those are examples of how bad news gets shrouded a bit and good news gets exposed.
Well, let's say you're a doctor and you're going to be calling a patient to let them know the results of an HIV test.
Yes.
Are there sort of bad and good ways to deliver bad and good news?
There certainly is. And let me first of all deal with bad news and then mention good news. First of all, the preferable way of delivering such news is in the office rather than over the telephone. And so if you can, instead of setting it up so that you as a clinician or counselor or a physician are calling the client or the patient, they have an appointment to come back and get the news, whatever it may be, in the office. That is by far preferred. I've already mentioned when the news is bad that a way of proceeding, and I have done studies in HIV testing clinics where, again, some clinicians will ask their clients, what do you think is going on here? you know what your risk is. Can you tell me what you think the outcome of this test is? I even know of one clinician who, when I was doing my study, would, instead of telling the client what his results were when it was an HIV positive result, would give him the piece of paper and say, I'm going to leave the room. I would like you to look at this. I'll come back in and then we're going to talk about it. And he would leave the room for just a little while. He'd come back in and he would say, what did you learn by reading that? And then again, it's the client who says, I can see that I've tested positive. And then the clinician can build upon that. But in a variety of ways, it's better for clinicians if they have the time. I mean, there are circumstances, for example, in emergency rooms where things happen so fast, you can't stand and say to the family member, do you what have do an think? Idea what yeah. happened? But in most other kinds of clinical settings, it's possible to ask for their view of what has been going on and then deliver the news in relationship to what their knowledge and beliefs are. And I should also mention, you know, there are, in fact, studies have been done on this. There's about 30% of patients who don't want to be collaborative in that way with their clinicians. And you can sometimes, if you're a physician who says, what do you think is going on? You can get a response like, you're the doctor. Would you please tell me?
Yeah, sure.
Well, it almost seems like teasing a patient almost if you know it and then you're asking them to guess. I mean, you could interpret it that way,
too. It does seem like avoidance, doesn't it? I mean, if you're just giving them something, here, you figure it out and I'll talk to you about it later. I mean, that I would think would be undesirable for most patients.
I think it depends on the manner in which you do that. You're not, in a sense, asking for the patient to guess in that sense. You're asking the patient or the family member what they already know and what their experience is.
I mean the sort of the here's a piece of paper.
The piece of paper
approach
thing,
would again, seem kind of impersonal to me.
Again, I think it's how it is that it's done. And this particular counselor was very good at giving them the piece of paper and saying in a compassionate way, I want you to look this over and then I'll come back and talk to you about it. Almost all of these things can be done in an insensitive way. And one of the things that I try to leave with clinicians is that there's probably no blanket strategy that's appropriate for every circumstance. And it's very important to read the circumstances and to know, for example, is this a patient who really prefers that I do the informing and doesn't want to have me asking them questions? And then you need to be more direct and respect that. But if it is, and, you know, somewhere around at least 60, maybe 70% of patients would prefer to be consulted about what their experience of their illness is or their family member's illness, then there's a way of respecting that by asking them what that experience is. I have a joke that conveys some of this complexity. It's about this man who has a cat, his beloved cat, and he has to go away on a trip. And he decides that he wants his brother to take care of his cat because it just would be better to have somebody in the family take care of the cat. He's going to get good care. So brother number one goes away on his trip. Brother number two is taking care of the cat. And brother number one has been on his trip for a few days, and he gets a call from brother number two, who says to him, well, I've got to tell you something. Your cat died. And there's a silence, and brother number one says, oh, that's awful. And he says, and I have to tell you, the way that you told me just so bluntly like that makes it worse. You could have been a little bit better in how you told me this news. I love that cat. So brother number two says, well, I don't know how I could have, the cat died. What am I supposed to do? I have to tell you. And brother number one says, well, what you could have done is you could have called me up and said, your cat is up on the roof and we can't get your cat down. And then we would have hung up, and then I could have gotten used to the idea that there's trouble here. And then you could have called me back and said, the cat is still up on the roof, and I'm not sure we're going to be able to get her down. And then we could have hung up, and then you could have called back finally and said, we didn't get the cat down, and I'm really sorry to tell you that your cat has died. If you would have told me that way, it just would have been a lot easier to accept this news. And brother number two says, okay, well, I'm really sorry. I'll try to do better. So brother number one has a fairly long trip, and he's gone for a while longer, and he gets a phone call again from brother number two. And brother number two says, mother is up on the roof, and we can't get her down. So why I like that story is that it illustrates that a particular tactic for delivering news might be appropriate in one circumstance, but you can't just say that tactic is appropriate in all circumstances.
Well, and people vary so much, too, in terms of how they take news and how they want it.
That's right. That's exactly right.
More on Dr. Patient Talk in a moment when we continue with University of the Year.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, Douglas Maynard, and we're talking about conversations between doctors and patients and how they can really play an important role in the patient's well-being. And we talked a fair amount about bad news just now and how doctors might deliver that. Is that assuming that delivering good news is a relatively easy thing to do, a foregone conclusion?
It's often perceived to be an easy thing to do, but good news also can be problematic to deliver. And I can give you a couple of different ways that that occurs. One is that in medicine, the logic of doing what they call a differential diagnosis is to rule out whatever conditions could be considered when a patient presents with certain kinds of symptoms. And usually physicians will start with the most severe possibility first and then rule out conditions progressively as they do their testing. And what can happen is that a patient may have symptoms that have not gotten a diagnosis. And then when the symptoms are considered and a diagnosis is ruled out, from a clinical point of view, that's good news. From the patient's point of view, what can happen is that they may still have the symptoms. And so while it's good news that this particular diagnosis is not explaining the symptoms, they're still left with those symptoms.
And wondering what is causing it and whether it might not be something even worse than this thing that's been ruled out.
That's right. And so what is good news from a clinical point of view then might be almost bad news from a patient's point of view. So that's one way that good news can have difficulties. We call it a symptom residue. There's a residue of symptoms that's left over and left unexplained by the ruling out of a particular diagnosis. Another way that this can happen is when a patient may in fact want to have a particular kind of diagnosis, and then that diagnosis is ruled out. And once again, from a clinical point of view, that may be good news, but it may not be especially good news from the patient's point of view. Let me give you an example, and I'll read this one. This is a patient who came to her primary care physician and had had some depression. And she also was having real difficulty with her job. She was in a situation that she disliked intensely. And she wanted to be evaluated for depression. And she also thought that it's possible that if she had a depression diagnosis, she could get a medical release so that she would not have to go to work and she could still collect disability and have an income. And so her internist sent her for evaluation to a psychiatrist, and the psychiatrist did a workup and sent his report back to the internal medicine physician. And here's how the dialogue went when the patient was to get her news from her primary care physician, but about what the psychiatrist had said. And so the patient asks her doctor, well, what did the psychiatrist tell you? And the doctor says, well, he said in the letter pretty much what you told me. He had a chance to look over your medical records before he wrote the letter, and he does not think that depression is an important part of your illness right now. And the patient is silent, and the doctor says, I think that's good news. Silence. I mean, if he's right. Silence. If he's right, it's good news. And he's pretty good at figuring these things out, I think. And the patient finally says, obviously, I've been having occasional periods of depression, but whether they're caused by other things or they're causing my difficulties. It's hard to know. So she's not happy with what is being presented to her as a good news diagnosis or ruling out of a diagnosis. And the silences, as we were talking about earlier, are good indications of somebody who's disaffiliating from what's being presented to her as good news.
Well, if you get into a psychiatric context, I can imagine a lot of bets would be off in terms of what's good news, bad news.
Well, that's true.
What have your studies shown about gender in doctor-patient talk? Because, I mean, in the past, women, for example, were often dismissed as emotional or hysterical or assumed to have certain nervous complaints. Attitudes went into how communication took place. And I'm just curious what you find in looking at what difference it makes whether the patient and doctor are male or female.
I haven't really had a chance to look at that because as a conversation analyst, I work with a relatively small number of conversational episodes. And we are looking for the basic patterns of how, in this instance, bad news or good news gets conveyed and how it is that the patient receives the news. And I don't have enough data to compare, for example, when the physician may be male and the patient may be female or the reverse or they're same gender or what have you. I can tell you impressionistically that I don't think there's a great deal of difference. I'll give you a different kind of example. I have an interview in which a patient, these are two men, but there's an ethnic difference. The doctor is a white male and the patient is an African-American male. And the doctor, again, an internist, has discovered they've diagnosed a very severe stomach cancer in the patient. And a question would be, and it's a very difficult diagnosis to present to this patient, and the patient is very upset when he gets the news. And right away, we had to consider the possibility that some of the difficulties in the conveyance, in the way in which they interact with one another, has to do with that it's a white physician and that the patient is African American. But from the analysis that we've done, the much larger dynamic is that this is bad news and that the relevant roles, so to speak, are a doctor conveying the bad news and the patient receiving the bad news. I've had a chance to show this to African American audiences and I ask them, do you see anything going on here that is contributing to the difficulties of this communication by virtue of the fact of the ethnic differences? And they've, to a person, said, no, this is all about a cancer diagnosis. That's not to say that there can't be difficulties deriving from ethnicity and certainly from gender, but I haven't been able to investigate it systematically in the way that you need to do this. My hope is that somebody will take this basic research and do the kind of design and the kind of study with the larger numbers where you could discover what the patterns might be.
If we were to summarize at this point and say, what is the doctor's responsibility and what is the patient's responsibility in their conversation, what would the results be?
The results would be somewhat different than has been presented in the medical literature and the social science literature so far. One of the reasons that I study interaction is because by studying interaction, that is to say how it is that one person talks, how it is that the other person receives, and then how that recipient of the talk becomes a talker in his or her own right such that the other person is now the recipient, means that there's a back and forth to the conversation. And this is true whether it's just ordinary conversation or whether it's in the doctor-patient relationship. And that means that patients have a contribution to the texture of the clinical communication that has been underappreciated in the past. In the past, there's been a great deal of emphasis. The focus has been almost entirely on what it is that the physicians are doing to the patients in that communication process. So by studying interaction, it's to appreciate the fact that this is a two-way communication. And in certain ways, it shows that patients have more control and power than has been previously suspected, I think, over how it is that the interview goes.
So the next time I go to the doctor and have my 11 minutes, I should use it wisely?
Yeah, that's right. Already do, actually. I think you probably have more wisdom about how to affect the way the doctor is communicating with you than you might suspect.
Our guest has been Doug Maynard. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Emily Auerbach with Norman Gilliland, hoping you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Year.
Next Sunday afternoon at 4 during University of the Year, we take a close look at India, a country that's going to have an increasing effect on the United States. Join us next Sunday afternoon at 4 for University of the Year, right here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.